My name is Joe Phillips. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
How are you all doing tonight?
You don't have to worry.
Yeah. Pleasure to be here. I was telling some folks before the meeting got going that I've been here before. I was here probably, I'm thinking 15 years ago. And I did some ranting that I kind of regret now. And so it's been nice for me to think that I've got an opportunity to, you know, do a little better than that this time around. But I am a real alcoholic. My home group is Buckingham Group. And I have a job in that group. I have a sponsor. I have sponsees. I'm pretty committed to this fellowship and have been for a long time. But that said, other than taking a drink, as I was thinking about this, I think I've made every mistake you can make. And I think the beauty of it is that I'm still here despite that. The God of my understanding is merciful. We all have drinking stories, and I'm not going to bore you with mine. One of the things that was important for me to learn, and again, I didn't learn it for a long time, was that I wasn't an alcoholic because of the consequences of my drinking. I was an alcoholic because of how I drank. And there are two things that I understand make me an alcoholic. And one is that when I take a drink, something happens in my body and I just keep going. One drink never made any sense to me. I mean, why? You know, there were times when I took a drink and just one because of some social situation. But once that was in there, I was looking at my watch for the opportunity to get out of there and find a place where I could drink the way I wanted to drink. I drank until I ran out or passed out, whichever came first. And I'm married to a normal drinker, and she will open a beer and sip it and put it down, pick it up and sip it again. And she repeats that until it gets warm, and then she pours half away. And I still think she's doing it wrong. You know, why would you do that? The other thing that makes me an alcoholic is that despite knowing that when I take a drink, I don't know where I'll end up, I always take a drink. You know, I have a mental obsession to drink. And the way that, at the end of my drinking, the way that manifests itself was I would wake up in the morning with whatever alcohol was still left. If I had passed out, there would be half a drink on the bedside table. If I didn't wake up in the middle of the night and finish it off, but I would wake up feeling terrible because I had told myself I wasn't going to get drunk just yesterday. I was never trying to give up drinking, but you know, I didn't want to drink that day. There were things I needed to do. I had a family. I had responsibilities. There are things I had to do outside of work. If I get drunk, I can't do those. So I'm not going to drink today. And every time I said that, I believed it, and I believed I could do it. And I would go to work and make my way through the day. And when I left work, without any thought on my part, I was in the parking lot of the nearest convenience store with a tall boy in my hand. I wasn't one of these people who said, this time it will be different. Or, you know, there was no thought involved. This is me on automatic pilot. And once that drink was in, you know, there was another couple stores I could stop at before I got home. And there we go again. You know, so that cycle went on. That was probably the last 3 years of my drinking was that kind of thing on a daily basis. And we're not talking about the weekends. That's when we can really relax. There is a third part that relates to my alcoholism, but it's not what makes me an alcoholic. It's what the book calls a spiritual malady. And this is the result of my trying to, you know, run my life on my own willpower and my viewpoint that I am the center of the universe. I basically cut myself off from any higher power, trying to run things on my own. And the result of that is just all kinds of negative feelings. I'm driven by anger and resentment and desire and, fear, insecurity, that's not what makes me an alcoholic. I can look around the world and see, there's lots of people out there with that who aren't alcoholics, right? But in my case, what happened and is that it seemed to fix, alcohol seemed to fix that stuff. And I vividly remember my first drink in this regard. I was probably about 16. I didn't get started real early because I was the oldest in a in my family. I have a brother and a sister. My mom and dad were alcoholic, but other than some sullen mood changes on my dad's part, it wasn't an abusive relationship. I don't have any complaints about how I was raised, and I don't think any of that made me an alcoholic. The only thing that might have done is given me the genetic thing, whatever that is. But I remember starting school in seventh grade, at a new school and looking around in the hallway at all these people and knowing that they all knew something I didn't know, that they had something that I didn't have, and I didn't know what it was, but I knew it meant that I wasn't going to succeed and I wasn't going to fit in. And if they knew who I really was, they weren't going to like me. And so, everything about my actions towards my fellows in school was all based on how can I fool them into liking me? Because I needed that because I didn't like myself. I was insecure, knew something was wrong with me, again, didn't know what it was. And part of going to schools, people would have parties on weekends, and I hated parties because, you go to a party and there's 30 people who can reject you. And I didn't know what to say. I didn't know, how to relax and act. And so I'd usually end up, eating potato chips or something like that. But I went to one of these parties again when I was about 16, and somebody had a cooler beer in the basement and gave me a Schlitz tall boy. And again, I wanted to be accepted, and the cool kids drank. So, okay, here we go. And I took a sip, and I couldn't believe that anyone voluntarily drank anything that tasted that bad. But cool kids drink, so I'm going to finish it. So I finished that beer, Schlitz tall boy, never forget that. And the magic happened. All of a sudden, I was comfortable. It's a party. And I could talk, I could relax and talk to people and smile, and I felt comfortable in my own skin. I never felt comfortable in my own skin. And I don't know that I really put two and two together, but down deep, what I did was I turned my will and my life over to the care of alcohol because it fixed what was wrong with me. All of this insecurity and fear I've been feeling, I just didn't have enough alcohol in my system, and so that explains at least somewhat to my satisfaction why alcohol could be so important to me, why I could develop an obsession for this thing. But anyhow, that's basically what makes me an alcoholic: the obsession, the mental obsession, the physical compulsion. So I didn't get into a lot of drinking trouble until I went away to school. I came to the University of Virginia in 1970. Don't think I need to say any more. In 2 weeks, the fraternity rush started, and there were all these groups of guys that wanted to give me all the beer I could drink. And so instead of going to classes, I was waking up in the bushes. It was a disaster. The long and short of it is, over time, I managed to get by. I don't particularly like the term functional alcoholic because when I think of how I functioned, it wasn't the way I wasn't functioning like I could. I wasn't doing what I could do. But I got by. I didn't encounter any serious consequences like losing jobs or things like that. I met a woman who drank like me. And we got married, and That solved another piece of how I showed to the world that I'm okay. Look at me, we're married, everything's great. That went on until that went on for a long time. I mean, all of our friends were people who drank like us. If you gravitate to that crowd, you can get together and drink the way you want to drink and not have to explain yourself to anybody. We all knew why we were there. And yes, I did outside issues. Like I said, school in 1970. I used them for the same reason. I'm not an addict. For a while, I did identify when before I knew better. There was a time when I came into this fellowship and identified myself as an alcoholic and an addict. But when I finally understood what made me an alcoholic, those things don't apply to those outside issues. You know, I don't have that obsession. I don't have that compulsion. I don't use them, but you know, I've turned that over to God. But I'm clear on what I am, and that's an alcoholic. And so, moving through time, I'm married now. I've got a job living in Charlottesville when my first son was born. Actually, say my first son, my only son, not counting my stepchildren. And about 2 years into that, my drinking had progressed to the point where I was starting to show some of the things my dad had shown. I was coming home, drinking, continuing to drink. And when I would drink, I would shut down. I would basically withdraw into myself, be sullen, kind of negative. If my wife wanted to talk to me, I didn't want to be bothered. You know, and part of it was I didn't want to look at what was going on because my life was going nowhere, just nowhere. And then one night, my wife told me that she didn't love me anymore and she wanted to leave. And, you know, instantly went into power drive mode. No, baby, you'll see, we'll fix this. You know, just nuts. It was already over. I was just the last to know it. But when I look at that, I can't say I blame her. I was not a loving, compassionate, understanding person to be married to. So, you know, it's no surprise to me that she was looking for someone else. But she did agree to go to counseling. And again, she was already gone, but she was going to do the right thing. So we went to counseling. The first session, the counselor said, I asked two questions. Number one, is there any violence in the household? Yeah, no violence. Okay, the second question is are drugs and alcohol part of what's going on? And we both went, yeah, I think so. And so now I had, you know, my out. I went to Blue Ridge Hospital and we were both diagnosed as alcoholic. And this was my out. I went to outpatient treatment. And it's important for me to say I didn't go to outpatient treatment because I wanted to get sober. I went to outpatient treatment because this was how I was going to fix my marriage. Yeah. And early on, I heard a couple of things that I really needed to hear in treatment. The first was they called me up short on that. They said, you're here to fix your marriage. You're not here to get sober. What happens when your marriage fails anyway? You're going to use it as an excuse to drink. And I don't know why, but that took. And I started doing it for myself. Another thing they told me that was helpful was they said spirituality is not religion. And I needed that because I had some prejudice against organized religion, that if it had been presented as a religious program, it would have been harder for me to get untracked on this. So that really smoothed that for me. They also told me some things that ultimately didn't help. They told me, if you're having a bad day, go to a meeting and make it your own. I don't see how that solves selfishness and self-centeredness, but that was the instructions I got. So I made a practice a lot of times to go into a discussion meeting, and when you wanted a topic, I wanted to talk about all my resentments. Another thing they said was, don't go past step three your first year. Yeah. In my cynical moments, I look at that as the treatment center's business plan for repeat customers. Okay. So anyhow, what treatment really was for me was a transition to AA. They you know, got you started in AA, told you, you know, that's where you're going to find the long-term solution to this. I started going to AA meetings and things went great. Understand that at that time, the language in meetings was very treatment center oriented. There was a lot of take your time to work the steps. There was an awful lot of it's an individual program, take what you want and leave the rest. One thing I heard a lot was just don't drink and go to meetings and things will get better. You know, and there were people talking about doing these things, the 12 steps. But that's harder. You know, I'm looking for an easier, softer way. You know, so I'm not blaming the meetings because I'm the person who made the choice. But my point is that the message wasn't, there wasn't a single message being carried. There were many messages being carried in the rooms. And I don't think that's much different from things we see today, but it had an impact on me. And you know, back then, if you were adamant about the program, you were likely to be called in a meeting a big book Nazi. And that was acceptable behavior in meetings back then. That was, people weren't called on that. So I started just not drinking a day at a time and going to meetings. And for a while, things were great because number one, I'm not drinking. I got in shape. I've got this aftercare program from treatment. So, you know, I'm going to a doctor and I'm healthy. I'm going to a psychiatrist and getting mental things taken care of. So I'm doing a lot of work on a lot of things. And I'm going to this fellowship that has all these people that are friendly and smart and, you know, accepting. So, you know, I had a great time, but I wasn't doing the work. Reminds me of that story where they say he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. You know, I was doing it on my own. And I didn't understand this at the time, but I was still writing the script. And moreover, I thought that I deserve to write the script now, you know, because I'm sober. You owe me. I misunderstood the first step. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, but then having stopped drinking, I thought now I'm qualified to manage my own life. Now I'll be able to manage my own life. And over time, it just went south like you wouldn't believe. It was at the end, it was a bloodbath. Took a while. I mean, when you put on weight, you don't get up, you don't see it happening until, you know, one morning down the road, you stand in front of the mirror and go, oh, where'd that come from? But I hit my real bottom 10 years after my last drink. I was dry for 10 years and my family suffered for this. My wife's description of a dry drunk is perfect and it's only five words. She said, nothing ever made him happy. Yeah. And nothing did because nobody was following the script I was writing. And when they didn't, I was getting resentful about it. You know, so now I've got this whole new crop of resentments. One of the things, again, one of those things that was said a lot was my worst day sober was better than my best day drunk. That is not my experience. I had some great days when I was drinking. I mean, there were some days where everything came together. Life was good. All it just needs to do is continue like this. My worst day sober was worse than my worst day drunk because I had all those symptoms of that spiritual malady, advanced another 10 years, and I couldn't even take a drink to get temporary oblivion from what I was feeling. I just had to lie there and take it. And I was crazy as a loon. I was lying in bed next to my wife, had to talk to her, couldn't talk to her, had to go to sleep, couldn't go to sleep. I was convinced that my children, I had gotten remarried, okay? Had a stepson and a stepdaughter. And I was convinced that night that they were waiting for me to go to sleep so they could sneak into my room and kill me. What? Just crazy. I mean, there was no basis for me to think that. And so when I look at this as my real bottom, I think one of the things that was going on was that I finally got to a point where I had tried every way I could think of to run my life the way I felt it needed to be run and failed every time. And I couldn't think of a new way that I could organize things to make it work. And so the thought that came to mind was maybe it's time to do those steps. Who knows where that came from? And so that a couple of days later, I was at the Friday afternoon. They had a speaker meeting in Charlottesville on Fry Springs Road. And the guy who was going to be my sponsor told his story. And one of the things he said was, I take people through in about 8 or 10 weeks. What? I'd been listening to this take your time stuff. I thought it was going to take years. I can 10 weeks, sure, let's go. And so he took me to the book, and again, I'd read this thing, but I didn't relate to it. I didn't see myself in it. It was a story of some alcoholics back in the Depression and some things they did. It was interesting reading, but I didn't see how it applied to me. And that's one of the things that I love about good sponsorship was we went through this thing page by page together, and he made me do things that helped me relate. One of the things was in Bill's story, writing when I thought like what I was reading, or when I drank like what I was reading, or when I felt like what I was reading, put a T or an F or a D in the margin, whenever you identify. And so I go through the chapter, and when I'm done, the margin's full of T's, F's, and D's. It's not a story about some stockbroker in the Depression. It's something that I can identify with. And the same thing with each alcoholic is like an actor who wants to run their own the show. Said, put your name in, write Joe there. Joe is like an actor who want, and read those two paragraphs, and it's true. It's me. So all of a sudden, this thing is relevant to me. And the other thing he pointed out was that it was an instruction manual, that it had instructions on how to work the steps. And so we started doing that right away. As we went through the book, I did what the instructions were, and everything changed. It was amazing. Again, I was trying to run the show, and one of my best examples of the change that started happening was, well, let me back up. One of the things he did early on when we were reading We Agnostics was we were faced with the proposition that God is everything or he's nothing. What's our choice to be? And so he had me do this exercise and say, okay, write down in this in the first column of this exercise, write down everything you haven't turned over to God. And I was taken aback by that. I turned over, step one. I was powerless over alcohol. Haven't I turned it over? How do I know what I haven't turned over? He said, well, put down anything you're having trouble with. And so I, by the time I finished that column, my wife, my kids, my job, my health, my relationship with the fellowship, everything. I mean, it was everything except my drinking. And what it showed me was that I had held on to everything. I was still trying to run everything. The next column was why I was afraid to do that. The irony of this still gets me is because it's too important for God. I know better what I'm afraid I'm not going to get what I need or get what I want or lose what I have. And in my mind, I know better than any higher power what I need. So, I'll give you my drinking, but this other stuff's too important. I got that. And that's how I was living my life. I got this stuff, and I didn't got that stuff. That stuff was getting me. And anyhow, so my family was a flashpoint for all this. I was constantly at odds with everyone in my family. And along about step four or five, I was walking down the steps in my home one day, and I realized that for about 10 days, I hadn't even raised my voice to any of them. No one in my family. You know, we had been doing everything. Everything had gone calmly and peacefully. And I realized right behind that, that they were still acting the way they always had. You know, that we weren't at peace because they were finally acting on my script. We were at peace because I had changed. I was the only one who had changed. And that was huge for me. That was a real moment of revelation for me to understand that that it was me, you know, that my responsibility in that stuff. Another big turning point was step nine, making my amends. And again, good sponsorship story. My sponsor sandbagged me. We made a card for each amend I was going to make, and he said, okay, rank them in order from easy, put the easiest one on the top and the hardest one on the bottom. And we'll start that way. You can start off with the easy ones. So by the time you get to the hard ones, you'll be comfortable with the process and you know what you're doing. And so I did that and I handed him the stack and he took four off the bottom and said, take care of them by next week. You know, he sandbagged me because he knew what I needed. Those were the ones that I had. Those were the ones that were eating me alive. You know, so I made those amends, and one of those I'll tell, not to tell a story, but just to illustrate the impact of it. One of those amends was to the guy my first wife had left me for, who had been my best friend for years. It was just as painful place as it could be. And he had told me that he had pretended to be my friend, and the only reason he came to my house was to see my wife and my son, and she married him, and we had joint custody of the kids, so I'm seeing them all the time at grade school things. And I took every opportunity I could to make him understand what I really thought of it, you know. And now I'm going to go apologize for that. Now, you tell that to someone who's not in this fellowship. What? You did what? And, but the point is that I had carried resentments against this guy for, you know, longer than a decade. I mean, ever since this happened, I had this longstanding resentment that I nursed and was just a part of who I was. And again, eating me alive. And I went in to make my amends to him. And he didn't get it, but the book says that they don't have to. I made my amends to him for how I had behaved. And when I left his house, those resentments were gone. I mean, they were lifted. This was the moment. This was the first moment where I was, there's something in my life that's bigger than me that's working, you know, because that wasn't me. There's still some doubt in my mind that when I left his house, my feet touched the ground. It was an amazing moment. I also understood somehow coming out of that there, but for the grace of God, go I. You know, things just started, you know, the work was what I needed to do, what had been missing, you know, this spiritual life that had to start somewhere. And, my wife, one of my sponsor's favorite stories is about a year after we started working, I had done the work and actually gone through it a second time. And she came to him at a party and had tears in her eyes and thanked him for the new husband. You know, he loves that story. Not that he believes he did it. I wish at this point I could say, and we all lived happily ever after. But it's not true. You know, now the journey's begun. And one of the first things that happened after being shown all that patience and tolerance for all those years, I was immediately, for lack of a better term, bleeding deacon. I like bleeding deacon because it sounds better than self-righteous jerk. You know, now I knew the answer. And you were going to hear it from me because I had it. And I looked around the fellowship and saw all the people that didn't. And I was going to change all that. And That's the Joe you got last time up here. Wasn't pretty. I was carrying a message of hope about what it had done for me and the importance of, what I was saying wasn't true. It was how I was saying it. Attraction rather than promotion, and there wasn't any attraction in this. I was telling Billy before the meeting, one of the common terms for people like me around those times was a big book thumper, and I didn't have any problem with the idea of being a thumper, but I was thumping like this. I was going upside your head with the big book. A guy in my home group calls it weaponizing the big book. You did it my way, or we're doing it wrong. And I look at all the things, all the attributes that I seek in a spiritual life. When you're talking about patience and understanding and compassion, there's none of that there. It was you're going to do it this way, or you're not working with me. And gee, how come no one's coming to me to be their sponsor? I sponsored a couple people, and that worked well. But I mean, I lost more than that, just from intolerance. No other way to put it. I finally, and I also started cutting myself off from the fellowship. That there were meetings that I would go to, but they were meetings that were Joe approved. If they followed the line of the first 164 pages and didn't stray outside of that, then it was a Joe approved meeting, and I went to those. And I don't know how long that went on, longer than I would have liked, but at some point I realized, or maybe I just started to change, understand things a little differently. Time doing the work, and time saying my prayers, and time doing my inventory. I started to back off a little bit, and the first part of that was realizing that, well, when you go to these Joe approved meetings and share your stuff, you're preaching to the choir. Everyone there is on the same page. When you're missing these meetings where everyone's not there, those are the meetings that have people in it that might need to hear what you've got to say. And I told my story once to a group, and about a year later, a guy came up to me and said, "I heard you share about how terrible it was just not drinking and the change that happened when you did the work." And so I went out and got a sponsor, and everything changed. I had that experience. Now, I didn't know that. He came and he did me the gift of coming and telling me that. But I mean, that's what needs to happen here, is share our experience, strengthen, share a message of hope. That's why I identify myself as recovered. I was in a meeting once where someone was saying, "The book says we've recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body, but where does it say we've recovered from alcoholism?" Title page. The book's Alcoholics Anonymous, and the page right under Alcoholics Anonymous is the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. My sponsor was pretty clear about that. And again, I'm not cured. I have that physical allergy. I'll have that all my life. If I drink, I'm off. But the mental obsession's been removed. And as long as I do what I need to do to maintain my spiritual condition, that'll continue to be the case. I'm confident of that. The only one who can get in the way of that is me, if I become unwilling to do the work. And then the next foray into bad recovery was, I moved to Buckingham County and was a long way from most meetings. And again, at this point, I was more program oriented than fellowship oriented. So, okay, I'm going to a couple meetings a week. That's okay. And then COVID hit. Now I'm going to one meeting, and now I'm not going to any meetings. That was probably the last time I ended up in counseling with my wife. Because again, it doesn't take long for me to start taking things back from my higher power. That list I was telling you about, I keep that list with me. And if something goes sideways in my life, I just have to look on that list and find out what I've taken back from God, because that's always what's going on. I've taken control of something. Basically, once the pandemic eased off, I got back into the fellowship and had the good fortune of getting into a home group that's really solid in all three legacies. And so I started to see and have explained to me and experience, you know, the benefits of getting more involved in the fellowship, both for myself and for those around me. And that's kind of where things are at now. I understand the three legacies, and that I need my sponsor. My sponsor described it as, you're standing on a tripod, and it's real stable as long as each leg is strong. But if any one of those legs gets weak and collapses, you're going down. And those three legs are the legacies of AA, recovery, unity, and service. And so that's what I try for now. And I still, you know, one of the, I guess the ongoing thing of recovery for me, the task, the path that I'm following, is this idea that I'm going to continually maintain my spiritual condition. And I have discovered this to be something that has to be done on a daily, ongoing basis. For a while there, I was out of the habit of praying on a daily basis. Big mistake. I can't pray myself into being spiritual, but those prayers and that meditation time remind me of what the problem is and what the solution is. And I've got a good example of that that happened just this week. I was down in the basement where I had my quiet time, and one of the readings of the day was talking about, you know, two things that we keep coming back to in a spiritual life are God consciousness and looking to be helpful to others. You know, that these two things keep coming back, and that if you boiled it down to those two, that's really spiritual living right there. If you can maintain a consciousness of God through the day and look for ways to be helpful to others. And I like that, you know, and I sat with it, took deep breaths, read it again, said my prayers, went out in the day. 3 hours later, a neighbor asked me to do a favor for her. And my reaction was, you know, she wasn't there. This was coming over as a text. I can't believe she's asking me to take care of her stuff. Doesn't she know I've got better things to do? And, you know, on and on and on down this, you know, imposition, you know, on me. And it wasn't an imposition at all. She was asking me to take a laptop into town to give it to a guy who had left it out there. He was going to meet me, so I didn't have to go anywhere special. It saved him 2 hours of driving, you know. And I'm just all up about what this is doing to me. But because I had said my prayers, those prayers that morning and done that reading, that only lasted about 5 minutes. And then I went, oh, wait a minute. God consciousness and helpful to others. I don't see any of that in what you just did. You know, that's not there. Yeah, you know, so was able to get redirected and ask God for help, and called my neighbor up and said, sure, I'd be happy to. Give me the guy's name and number. Called him up. Everything went great, you know. And you know, I'm getting in the way of a nice experience through my selfishness and self-centeredness. You know, acting the way I was acting, I was blocking myself from something that turned out to be really nice. You know, and the assumptions in there are so negative. I mean, I'm acting like she's looking for ways to make my life bad. And actually what's happening is she must have considered that I'd be a reasonable person, you know, a person that she could ask to do a favor. You know, she had a good opinion of me. I'm glad I didn't destroy it. Yeah, I'm glad it was, I'm glad that happened by text and not by phone. Okay. But that's the illustration. If I don't do this every day, if I don't surrender on a daily basis to me being the problem and spiritual living and my higher power being the solution, I haven't got a chance. You know, even when I do those things, I'm going to make mistakes. I'm human, always will. But, you know, I've got to keep trying to make this work the way it's working. And I think that the thing that when I look at this, you know, again, making all these mistakes and, you know, the only one I didn't make was not drinking, was drinking again. But we had a fellow come up from when I was in Charlottesville. My last home group was the Preamblers, and we had a symposium where we had a guy come up from Texas, and he got up early enough to tell his story Friday night. And one of the things he said has stuck with me. He said, "Thank God this program's not about justice; it's about mercy. Thank God for that." And I love that because I don't want what I deserve. You know, if I get what I deserve, I'm in deep trouble. You know, the God of my understanding is compassionate and forgiving and loving, and not the vengeful, wrathful God that I learned about growing up. That vengeful, wrathful person, that's me. You know, you cross me in active alcoholism, and you know, it's vengeful, wrathful time. You know, the only way I can be understanding and compassionate and forgiving is to basically understand that I can't be that way unless I connect to a higher power and try on a daily basis to live this life. And seems to be working pretty well so far. It's been a long, bumpy road, but they talk about trudging the road, and it's all been good. I don't think there's anything unusual about my story. Just it's I'm happy to be able to have been experiencing this long enough to go through those changes and to see those changes. And as time goes on, I feel better and better about where I'm headed. And I think that's all I got. Thanks for listening to me.